From PRI, Public Radio International.
Just above the brown line of the horizon, faint as a watermark on pale blue paper, was the wavering tracery of the mountains, tenuous and far off, but today accessible for the first time. His mind had played among those ghostly summits for uncountable lost hours. Today, in a few strides, they were his.
And more. Under the shadow of those peaks, under those bare paws that he and his mother privately called the Mountains of the Moon, was Chinook. And in Chinook, on this 4th of July, were the band, the lemonade stands, the crowds, the parade, the ball game, the fireworks that his mind had hungered toward in anticipation for 3 weeks.
You're listening to an excerpt from Wallace Stegner's Going to Town, a story we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Traveling Tales. The stories on this program were the fruit of a Selected Shorts visit to the state of Utah. When we were invited to bring a program of stories to the beautiful auditorium of the new City Library in Salt Lake City, a stunning edifice designed by the architect Moshe Safdie, our producer Catherine Minton and I consulted with our friends at the Utah Humanities Council about which Utah authors we might consider, and their response was to urge that we read from the works of Wallace Stegner, who, though he wasn't born in Utah, spent a good part of his life there and depicted it in his novels and short fictions. I must confess my prior ignorance of this fine, vivid word painter, of the harsh and majestic Western landscapes and the inner struggles of the people who inhabit them. But reading Stegner was an eye-opener, and we ended up bookending the program of Utah authors with two different Stegner tales, each somehow connected to cars, and each depicting a spiritual as well as a physical journey. We'll hear these two stories now. In the first, entitled The Traveler, the traveling salesman's car breaks down in the snow on an isolated country road on a dark night. In the course of his efforts to get help and to simply survive, the man finds himself, to his surprise, on a journey of self-discovery. The reader is Jack Davidson.
He was rolling in the first early dark down a snowy road, his headlights pinched between dark walls of trees, when the engine coughed, recovered, coughed again, and died. Down a slight hill, he coasted in compression, working the choke, but at the bottom, he had to pull over against the 3-foot wall of plowed snow. Snow creaked under the tires as the car eased to a stop. The heater fan unwound with a final tinny sigh. Here, in its middle age, this hitherto dependable mechanism had betrayed him, but he refused to admit it immediately that he was betrayed. Some speck of dirt or bubble of water in the gas line, some momentary short circuit, some splash of snow on distributor points or plug connections, something that would cure itself before long. But turning off the lights and pressing on the starter brought no result. He held the choke out for several seconds and got only the hopeful stink of gasoline. He waited and let the flooded carburetor rest and tried again, and nothing. Eventually, he opened the door and stepped out into the packed snow of the road. It was so cold that his first breath turned to iron in his throat. The hairs in his nostrils webbed into instant ice. His eyes stung and watered. In the faint starlight and bluish luminescence of the snow, everything beyond a few yards away swam deceptive and without depth, glimmering with things half seen or imagined. Beside the dead car, he stood with his head bent, listening, and there was not a sound. Everything on the planet might have died in the cold. Indecisively seeking help, he walked to the top of the next rise, but the faintly darker furrow of the road blurred and disappeared in the murk. The shadows pressed inward. There was no sign of a light. Back at the car, he made the efforts that the morality of self-reliance demanded. Trying to see by the backward diffusion of the headlamps, he groped over the motor, feeling for broken wires or loose connections, until he had satisfied himself that he was helpless. He had known all along that he was. His hands were already stung with cold, and around his ankles, between low shoes and trouser cuffs, he felt the chill like leg irons. When he had last stopped 20 miles back, it had been below zero. It could be 10 or 15 below now. So what did he do, stranded in mid-journey, 50 miles or more from his destination? He could hardly go in for help, leaving the sample cases, because the right rear door didn't lock properly. A little jiggling swung it open. And all those drugs, some of them designed to cure anything, wonder drugs, sulfas, streptomycin, areomycin, penicillin, pills, and antitoxins, and unguents, represented not only a value, but a danger. They should not be left around loose. Someone might think they really would cure anything. Not quite everything, he told the blue darkness. Not a fouled-up distributor or a cranky coil box. Absurdly, there came into his mind a fragment of an ancient hymn to mechanical transport. If she runs out of dope, just fill her up with soap, and the little Ford will ramble right along. He saw himself pouring a bottle of penicillin into the gas tank and driving off with the exhaust blowing happy smoke rings. A mock heroic montage of scientific discovery unreeled itself. White-coated scientists peering into microscopes, adjusting gauges, pipetting precious liquids, weighing grains of powder on a minuscule scale. Messenger boys sped with telegrams to the desks of busy executives. A group of observers stood beside an assembly line while the first tests were made. They broke a car's axle with sledges, gave it a drink of the wonder compound, and drove it off. They demolished the carburetor and cured it with one application. They yanked loose all the wires and watched the same magic set the motor purring. But here he stood in light overcoat and thin leather gloves without overshoes, and his car all but blocked the road, and the door could not be locked, and there was not a possibility that he could carry the heavy cases with him to the next farm or village. He switched on the headlights again and studied the roadside they revealed and saw a rail fence with cedars and spruces behind it. When more complex gadgets and more complex cures failed, there was always the Lucifer match. 10 minutes later, he was sitting with the auto robe over his head and shoulders and his back against the plowed snowbank, digging the half-melted snow from inside his shoes and gloating over the growing light and warmth of the fire. He had a supply of fence rails good for an hour. In that time, someone would come along and he could get a push or two. In this country, in winter, no one ever passed up a stranded motorist. In the stillness, the flames went straight upward. The heat was wonderfully pleasant on icy hands and numb ankles and stiffened face. He looked across the road, stained by horses, broken by wheel and runner tracks, and saw how the roadside acquired definition and sharp angles and shadows in the firelight. He saw, too, how he would look to anyone coming along, like a calendar picture. But no one came along. 15 minutes stretched into a half hour. He had only two broken pieces of rail left. The fire sizzled, half floating in the puddle of its melting. Restlessly, he rose with the blanket around him and walked back up the road 100 steps. Eastward, above jagged trees, he saw the sky where it lightened to moonrise. But here there was still only the blue glimmer of starlight on the snow. Something long buried and forgotten, tugged in him, and a shiver, not entirely from the cold, prickled his whole body with goose flesh. There had been times in his childhood when he had walked home alone and been temporarily lost in nights like this. In many years, he could not remember being out alone under such a sky. He felt spooked. His feet were chilled lumps. His nose leaked. Down the hill, car and snow swam deceptively together. The red wink of the fire seemed inexpressively far off. Abruptly, he did not want to wait in that lonely snowbank ditch any longer. The sample cases could look after themselves. Any motorist who passed could take his own chances. He would walk ahead to the nearest help, and if he found himself getting too cold on the way, he could always build another fire. The thought of action cheered him. He admitted to himself that he was all but terrified at the silence and the iron cold. Closing the car doors, he dropped his key case, and panic stopped his pulse as he bent and frantically, with bare hands, brushed away the snow until he found it. The powdery snow ached and burned at his fingertips. He held them a last moment to the fire, and then, bundled like a squaw with a blanket held across his nose and mouth to ease the harshness of the cold in his lungs, he started up the road that looked as smooth as a tablecloth, but was deceptively rough and broken. He thought of what he had had every right to expect for this evening. By now, 8 o'clock or so, he should have had a smoking supper, the luxury of a hot bath, the pleasure of a brandy in a comradely bar. By now, he should be in pajamas, making out sales reports by the bedlight in a room where steam knocked comfortingly in the radiators, and the help of 100 hands was available to him at a word into the telephone. For all of this to be torn away suddenly, for him to be stumbling up a deserted road in danger of freezing to death just because some simple mechanical part that had functioned for 30,000 miles refused to function any longer, this was outrage, and he hated it. He thought of garage men and service station attendants he could blame, ignoring the evidence of the flooded carburetor. He brooded about watered gas that could make ice in the gas line. A man was dependent on too many people. He was at everybody's mercy. And then, on top of the second long rise, he met the moon. Instantly, the character of the night changed. The uncertain starlight was replaced by a step by an even flood of blue-white radiance. He looked across a snow meadow and saw how a rail fence had every stake and rider doubled in solid shadow, and how the edge of woods beyond was blackest India ink. The road ahead was drawn with a ruler, one bank smoothed by the flood of light, the other deeply shadowed. As he looked into the eye of the moon, he saw the air shiver and glint with falling particles of frost. In this white Christmas night, this good King Wenceslas night, he went warily, not to be caught up in sentimentality. And to an invisible audience, he deprecated it profanely as a night in which no one would believe. Yet here it was, and he in it. With the coming of the moon, the night even seemed to warm. He found that he could drop the blanket from across his face and drink the still air. Along the roadside, as he passed the meadow and entered woods again, the moon showed him things. In moonlit openings, he saw the snow stitched with tiny, perfect tracks, mouse or weasel or the three-toed crowding tracks of partridge. These, too, an indigenous part of the night, came back to him as things once known and long forgotten. In his boyhood, he had trapped and hunted the animals that made such tracks as these. It was as if his mind were a snowfield where the marks of their secret little feet had been printed long ago. With a queer tightening of the throat, with an odd pride, he read the trail of a fox that had wallowed through the soft snow from the woods, angling into the packed road and along it for a little way, and out again, still angling across the plowed bank, and then left a purposeful trail of cleanly punched tracks, the hind feet in line with the front, across the clean snow and into the opposite wood, from shadow across moonlight and into shadow again. Turning with the road, he passed through the stretch of woods and came into the open to see the moonwhite, shadow-black buildings of a farm and the weak bloom of a light in a window. His feet whined on the snow, dry as metal powder, as he turned in the loop of drive the county plow had cleared. But as he approached the house, doubt touched him. In spite of the light, the place looked unused somehow. No dog welcomed him. The sound of his feet in the snow was alien. The hammer of his knuckles on the door an intrusion. Looking upward for some trace of telephone wires, he saw none, and he could not tell whether the quivering of the air that he thought he saw above the chimney was heat or smoke or the phantasmal falling frost. "Hello?" he said and knocked again. "Anybody home?" No sound answered him. He saw the moon glint on the great icicles along the eaves. His numb hand ached with the pain of knocking. He pounded with the soft edge of his fist. Answers finally came, not from the door before which he stood, but from the barn, down at the end of a staggered string of attached sheds. A door creaked open against a snowbank, and a figure with a lantern appeared, stood for a moment, and came running. The traveler wondered at the way it came, lurching and stumbling in the uneven snow until it arrived at the porch and he saw that it was a boy of 11 or 12. The boy set his lantern on the porch. Between the upturned collar of his mackinaw and the down-pulled stocking cap, his face was pinched whiteness, his eyes enormous. He stared at the traveler, until the traveler became aware of the blanket he still held over head and shoulders and began to laugh. "My car stopped on me a mile or so up the road," he said. "I was just hunting a telephone or some place where I could get help." The boy swallowed, wiped the back of his mitt across his nose. "Grandpa's sick," he blurted and opened the door. Warmth rushed in their faces, cold rushed in at their backs. Warm and cold mingled in an eddy of air as the door closed. The traveler saw a cot bed pulled close to the kitchen range, and on the cot an old man covered with a quilt who breathed heavily and whose closed eyes did not open when the two came near. The gray-whiskered cheeks were sunken, the mouth opened to expose toothless gums in a parody look of ancient mischief. "He must have had a shock," the boy said. "I came in from chores and he was on the floor." He stared at the mummy under the quilt and he swallowed. "Has he come to at all?" "No." "Only the two of you live here?" "Yes." "No telephone?" "No." "How long ago did you find him?" "Chore time, about 6. "Why didn't you go for help?" The boy looked down ashamed. "It's near 2 miles. I was afraid he'd..." "But you left him. You were in the barn." "I was hitching up to go," the boy said. "I'd made up my mind." The traveler backed away from the stove, his face smarting with the heat, his fingers and feet beginning to ache. He looked at the old man and knew that here, as at the car, he was helpless. The boy's thin, anxious face told him how thoroughly his own emergency had been swallowed up in this other one. He had been altered from a man in need of help to one who must give it. Salesman of wonder cures, he must now produce something to calm this overworried boy, restore a dying man. Rebelliously victimized by circumstances, he said, "Where were you going for help?" "The hill place, they got a phone." "How far are they from town?" About 5 miles. Doctor there? Yes. If I took your horse and, what is it, a sleigh? Could someone at the hills bring them back, do you think? Cutter. One of the hills boys could, I should say. Or would you rather go while I look after your grandpa? He don't know you, the boy said directly. If he should wake up, he might wonder. It might... The traveler grudgingly gave up the prospect of staying in the warm kitchen while the boy did the work. And he granted that it was extraordinarily sensitive of the boy to know how it might disturb a man to wake from a sickness in his own house and stare into the face of an utter stranger. Yes, he said. Well, I could call the doctor from the hills. 2 miles, did you say? About. The boy had pulled the stocking cap off so that his hair stood on end above his white forehead. He had odd eyes, very large and dark and intelligent, with an expectancy in them. The traveler, watching him with interest, said, "How long have you lived with your grandfather?" 2 years. Parents living? No, sir, that's why. Go to school? He got a queer sidling look. Have to till you're 16. Is that the only reason you go? What he was trying to force out of the boy came out indirectly with a shrugging of the shoulders. Grandpa would take me out if he could. Would you be glad? No, sir, the boy said, but would not look at him. I like school. The traveler consciously corked his flow of questions. Once he himself had been an orphan living with his grandparents on a back farm. He wondered if this boy went as he had gone, knocking in imagination at all of life's closed doors. The old man's harsh breathing filled the over-warm room. Well, the traveler said, maybe you better go finish hitching up. It's been 30 years since I harnessed a horse. I'll keep an eye on your grandpa. Pulling the stocking cap over his disheveled hair, the boy slid out the door. The traveler unbuttoned his overcoat and sat down beside the old man, felt the spurting, weak pulse, raised one eyelid with his thumb, and looked without comprehension at the uprolled eye. He knew it was like feeling over a chilling motor for loose wires, and after 2 or 3 abortive motions, he gave it up and sat contemplating the gray, sunken face, the unfamiliar face of an old man who would die, and thinking that the face was the only unfamiliar thing about the whole night. The kitchen smells, coffee and peanut butter, and the moldy, barky smell of wood from the wood box, and the smell of the hot range and of paint baking in the heat, those were as familiar as light or dark. The spectacular night outside, the snowfields, and the moon in the mysterious woods, the tracks venturing out across the snow from protective eaves of firs and skunk spruce, the speculative imagining expressions of the boy's eyes were just as familiar. He sat bemused, touching some brink as a man will walk along a cut bank trying to knock loose the crumbling overhang with an outstretched foot. The ways a man fitted in with himself and with other human beings were curious and complex. And when he heard the jingle and creak outside and buttoned himself into the overcoat again and wrapped his shoulders in the blanket and stepped out into the yard, there was a moment when the boy passed him the lines and they stood facing each other in the broken snow. It was a moment like farewell. Like a poignant parting. Touched by his pressing sense of familiarity and by a sort of compassion, the traveler reached out and laid his hand on the boy's shoulder. "Don't worry," he said. "I'll have someone back here right away. Your grandfather will be all right. Just keep him warm. Don't worry." He climbed into the cutter and pulled over his lap the balding buffalo robe he found there. The scallop of its felt edges was like a key that fitted a door. The horses breathed jets of steam in the moonlight, restlessly moving, jingling their harness bells as the moment lengthened itself. The traveler saw how the boy, now that his anxiety was somewhat quieted, now that he had been able to unload part of his burden, watched him with 1,000 questions in his face, and he remembered how he himself, 30 years ago, had searched the faces of passing strangers for something he could not name, how he had listened to their steps and seen their shadows lengthen ahead of them down roads that led to unimaginable places, and how he had ached with the desire to know them, who they were. But none of them had looked back at him as he tried now to look at this boy. He was glad that no names had been spoken and no personal histories exchanged to obscure this meeting. For sitting in the sleigh above the boy's white, upturned, serious face, he felt that some profound contact had unintentionally, almost casually, been made. For half a breath, he was utterly bewitched, frozen at the heart of some icy dream. Abruptly, he slapped the reins across the backs of the horses. The cutter jerked and then slid smoothly out towards the road. The traveler looked back once to fix forever the picture of himself standing silently watching himself go. As he slid into the road, the horses broke into a trot. The icy flow of air locked his throat and made him let go the reins with one hand to pull the hairy, wool-smelling edge of the blanket all but shut across his face. Along a road he had never driven, he went swiftly towards an unknown farm and an unknown town to distribute, according to some wise law, part of the burden of the boy's emergency and his own. But he bore in his mind, bright as moonlight over snow, a vivid wonder, almost an awe. For from the most chronic and incurable of ills, identity, he had looked outward and for one unmistakable instant recognized himself. Thank you.
Wallace Stegner's story, The Traveler, read for us by Jack Davidson. After a short break, we'll hear another great Stegner story in an arrangement for three voices. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. This program, recorded in Salt Lake City, was generously sponsored by Chevron. Our first Wallace Stegner story began with a car breaking down. This one begins with an old flivver that just won't start, no matter how much the father cranks it up and fiddles with the wires under the hood. And this is very bad news for the young boy who has looked forward to the day when his parents and he would drive from the isolated hardscrabble farm to the faraway nearest town for a picnic, rides, fireworks, and holiday parades that will break the monotony of the endless repetitive chores of farm life. Much of the drama of this story has to do with the outward mechanics of trying to start the inert jalopy, but a great deal has to do with the inner emotional life of father, mother, and boy. This led us to try a rare innovation in our Selected Shorts style, arranging the third-person narration and the three-way family conversation among three voices, the actress Lilo Wei as the voice of the young boy, and Jack Davidson and I as the father and mother. Wallace Stegner's Going to Town.
After the night's rain, the yard was spongy and soft under the boy's bare feet. He stood at the edge of the packed dooryard in the flat thrust of sunrise, looking at the ground washed clean and smooth and trackless, feeling the cool, firm mud under his toes. Experimentally, he lifted his right foot and put it down in a new place, pressed, picked it up again to look at the neat imprint of straight edge and curving instep, and the five round dots of toes. The air was so fresh that he sniffed at it as he would have sniffed at the smell of cinnamon.
Lifting his head backward, he saw how the prairie beyond the fire guard looked darker than in dry times, healthier with green-brown tints, smaller and more intimate somehow than it did when the heat waves crawled over scorched grass and carried the horizons backward into dim and unseeable distances. And standing in the yard above his one clean, sharp footprint, feeling his own verticality and all that spread of horizontal land, he sensed how the prairie shrank on this morning and how he himself grew. He was immense. A little jump would crack his head on the sky. A few strides would take him to any horizon.
His eyes turned south, into the low south sky, cloudless, almost colorless in the strong light, just above the brown line of the horizon, faint as a watermark on pale blue paper, was the wavering tracery of the mountains, tenuous and far off, but today accessible for the first time. His mind had played among those ghostly summits for uncountable lost hours. Today, in a few strides, they were his.
And more. Under the shadow of those peaks, under those bear paws that he and his mother privately called the Mountains of the Moon, was Chinook. And in Chinook, on this 4th of July, were the band, the lemonade stands, the crowds, the parade, the ball game, the fireworks that his mind had hungered toward in anticipation for 3 weeks.
His shepherd pup lay watching, belly down on the damp ground. In a gleeful spasm, the boy stooped down to flap the pup's ears, then bent and spun like an Indian in a war dance while the wide-mouthed dog raced around him.
And when his father came to the door in his undershirt, yawning, running a hand up the back of his head and through his hair, peering out from gummed eyes to see how the weather looked, the boy watched him. And his voice was one deep breathing relief from yesterday's rainy fear.
It's clear as a bell, he said.
His father yawned again, clopped his jaws, rubbed his eyes, mumbled something from a mouth furry with sleep. He stood on the doorstep, scratching himself comfortably, looking down at the boy and the dog.
Gonna be hot, he said slyly. Might be too hot to drive.
Oh, Paw.
Gonna be a scorcher. Melt you right down to axle grease riding in that car.
The boy regarded him doubtfully, saw the lurking sly droop of his mouth. Ah, we are too going.
At his father's laugh, he burst from his immobility like a sprinter starting, raced one complete circle of the house with the dog after him. When he flew around past his father again, his voice trailed out behind him at the corner of the house.
Gonna feed the hens, he said.
His father looked after him, scratched himself, laughed suddenly, and went back indoors.
Through chores and breakfast, the boy moved with the dream of a day's rapture haunting his eyes. But that did not keep him from swift and agile helpfulness. He didn't even wait for commands. He scrubbed himself twice, slicked down his hair, hunted up clean clothes, wiped the mud from his shoes with a wet rag, and put them on. While his mother packed the shoebox of lunch, he stood at her elbows, proffering aid. He flew to stow things in the topless old Ford. He got a cloth and polished the brass radiator. Once or twice, jumping around to help, he looked up to catch his parents watching him, or looking at each other with the knowing, smiling expression in the eyes that said they were calling each other's attention to him.
Just like a racehorse, his father said once, and the boy felt foolish. Swaggered, twisted his mouth down in a leer,
said. But in a moment, he was hustling them again. They ought to get going with 50 miles to drive. And long before they were ready, he was standing beside the Ford, licked and immaculate, and so excited that his feet jumped him up and down without his volition or knowledge.
It was 8 o'clock before his father came out, lifted off the front seat, poked the flat stick down into the gas tank, and pulled it out again, dripping.
Pretty near full, he said. If we're going to drive up to the mountain, we better take a can along, though. Fill that 2-gallon one with the spout.
The boy ran, dug the can out of the shed, filled it from the spigot of the 60-gallon drum that stood on a plank support to the north of the farmhouse. When he came back, his left arm stuck straight out, and the can knocking against his legs, his mother was settling herself into the back seat among the parcels and water bags. "Goodness," she said, "this is the first time I've been the first ready since I don't know when. I should think you'd have got all this done last night."
"Plenty time." The father stood looking down at the boy, grinning. "All right, racehorse, you want to go to this shindig, you better hop in."
The boy was up into the front seat like a squirrel. His father walked around in front of the car.
"Okay," he said. "You look sharp now. When she kicks over, switch her onto magneto and pull the spark plug down." The boy said nothing. He looked upon the car, as his father did, with a respect and a little awe. They didn't use it much, and starting it was a ritual like a fire drill. The father unscrewed the 4-eared brass plug, looked down into the radiator, screwed the cap back on, and bent to take hold of the crank. "Watch it now," he said.
The boy felt the gentle heave of the springs up and down as his father wound the crank. He heard the gentle hiss in the bowels of the engine as the choke wire was pulled out, and his nostrils filled with the strong, volatile odor of gasoline.
Over the slope of the radiator, his father's brown-stained face lifted up. "Is she turned on all right?"
"Yep, she's on battery."
"Must have fluttered her. Have to let her rest a minute." They waited. And then after a few minutes, the wave-like heaving of the springs again, the rise and fall of the blue shirt and bent head over the radiator, the sighing swish of the choke, a stronger smell of gasoline. The motor had not even coughed. The two voices came simultaneously from the car.
What's the matter with it? His brow puckered in an intent and serious scowl. The father stood blowing mighty breaths.
"Son of a gun," he said.
Coming around, he pulled at the switch to make sure it was clear over, adjusted the spark and gas levers. A fine mist of sweat made his face shine like oiled leather in the sun. "There isn't anything really wrong with it, is there?" the mother said, and her voice wavered uncertainly on the edge of fear.
"I don't see how there could be," he said. "She's always started right off, and she was running all right when I drove her in here."
The boy looked at his mother where she sat erect among the things in the seat. She looked all dressed up, a flowered dress, a hat with hard red varnished cherries on it pinned to her red hair. For a moment she sat stiff and nervous. "What'll you do?" she said.
"I don't know. Look into the motor."
"Well, I guess I'll get in out of the sun while you do it," she said, and opening the door she fumbled her way out of the clutter.
The boy felt her exodus like a surrender, a betrayal. If they didn't hurry up, they'd miss the parade. In one motion, he bounded out of the car. "Gee whiz," he said. "Let's do something. We got to get started."
"Keep your shirt on," his father grunted. Lifting the hood, he bent his head inside, studying the engine. His hand went out to test wires, wiggle spark plug connections, make tentative pulls at the choke. The weakly hinged hood slipped and came down across his wrist, and he swore, pushing it back. "Get me the pliers," he said. For 10 minutes, he probed and monkeyed. "Might be the spark plugs," he said. "She just don't seem to be getting any fire through her."
The mother, sitting on a box in the shade, smoothed her flowered voile dress nervously. "Will it take long?"
"Half hour."
"Any day but this," she said. "I don't see why you didn't make sure last night."
He breathed through his nose and bent over the engine again. "Don't go laying on any blame," he said. "It was raining last night."
One by one, the plugs came out, were squinted at, scraped with a knife blade, the gap tested with a thin dime. The boy stood on one foot, then on the other, time pouring like a flood of uncatchable silver dollars through his hands. He kept looking at the sun, estimating how much time there was left. If they got started right away, they might still make it for the parade, but it would be close. Maybe they'd drive right up the street while the parade was on and be part of it. "Is she ready?" he said.
"Pretty quick."
He wandered over by his mother, and she reached out and put an arm around his shoulders, hugging him quickly. "Well, anyway, we'll get there for the band and the ball game and the fireworks," he said. "If she doesn't start till noon, we can make it for those."
"Sure," she said. "Pa will get it going in a minute. We won't miss anything, hardly."
"You ever seen skyrockets, Ma?"
"Once."
"Are they fun?"
"Wonderful," she said. "Just like a million stars, all colors, exploding all at once." His feet took him back to his father, who straightened up with a belligerent grunt.
"Now," he said, "if the sucker doesn't start now."
And once more, the heaving of the springs, the groaning of the turning engine, the hiss of choke. He tried short, sharp half turns, as if to catch the motor off guard. Then he went back to the stubborn, laboring spin. The back of his blue shirt was stained darkly, the carving dikes of muscle along the spine's hollow showing clearly where the cloth stuck. Over and over, heaving, stubborn at first, then furious, until he staggered back, panting.
"God," he said, "what you suppose is the matter with the damn thing?"
"She didn't even cough once," the boy said, and staring up at his father's face, full of angry bafflement, he felt the cold fear touch him. What if it didn't start at all? What if they never got to any of it? What if, all ready to go, they had to turn around and unload the Ford and not even get out of the yard?
His mother came over, and they stood close together looking at the Ford and avoiding each other's eyes.
"Maybe something got wet last night," she said.
"Well, it had plenty of time to dry out," said the father.
"Isn't there anything else you can try?"
"We can jack up the hind wheel, I guess, but there's no damn reason we ought to have to."
"Well, if you have to, you'll have to," she said briskly. "After planning it for 3 weeks, we can't just get stuck like this, can we, son?"
His answer was mechanical, his eyes steady on his father. "Sure not," he said.
The father opened his mouth to say something, saw the boy's lugubrious face, and shut his lips again. Without a word, he pulled off a seat and got out the jack.
The sun climbed steadily while they jacked up one hind wheel and blocked the car carefully so that it wouldn't run over anybody when it started.
The boy helped, and when they were ready again, he sat in the front seat so full of hope and fear that his whole body was one taut concentration.
His father stooped, his cheek pressed against the radiator as a milker's cheek touches the flank of a cow. His shoulder dropped, jerked up. Nothing. Another jerk. Nothing. Then he was rolling in a furious spasm of energy, the wet, dark back of his shirt rising and falling, and inside the motor only the futile swish of the choke and the half-sound, half-feel of cavernous motion as the crankshaft turned over. The Ford bounced on its springs as if the front wheels were coming off the ground on every upstroke. Then it stopped, and the boy's father was hanging on the radiator, breathless, dripping wet, and swearing.
"Son of a dirty, lousy, stinking, corrupted..."
The boy, his eyes dark, stared from his father's angry, wet face to his mother's, pinched with worry. The pup lay down in the shade and put his head on his paws. "Gee whiz," the boy said. "Gee whiz." He looked at the sky, and the morning was half gone.
His shoulders jerking with anger, the father threw the crank halfway across the yard and took a step or two toward the house.
"The hell with the damn thing!"
"Harry, you can't!" He stopped, glared at her, took an oblique look at the boy, bared his teeth in an irresolute, silent swear word.
"Well, God, if it won't go!"
Maybe if you hitched the horses to it," she said.
His laugh was short and choppy. "That'd be fine," he said. "Why don't we just hitch up and let the team haul this damn old boat into the Chinook?"
"But we've got to get it started. Why wouldn't it be all right to let them pull it around? You push it sometimes on a hill, and it starts." He looked at the boy again, jerked his eyes away with an exasperated gesture, as if he held the boy somehow accountable.
The boy stared, mournful, defeated, ready to cry, and his father's head swung back unwillingly.
Then abruptly he winked, mopped his head and neck, and grinned. Think you want to go, huh?
The boy nodded.
All right. His father's voice snapped crisply. Fly up in the pasture and get the team. Hustle.
On the high lope, the boy was off up the coulee bank. Just down under the lip of the swale, a quarter mile west, the bay backs of the horses and the black dot of the colt showed. Usually, he ran circumspectly across that pasture because of the cactus, but now he flew. With shoes, it was all right, and even without shoes, he would have run across burnouts, over stretches so undermined with gopher holes that sometimes he broke through to the ankle, staggering. Skimming over patches of cactus, soaring over a badger hole, plunging down into the coulee and up the other side, he ran as if bears were after him. The black colt, spotting him, hoisted his tail and took off in a spectacular stiff-legged sprint across the flats. But the bays merely lifted their heads to watch him. He slowed, came up walking, laid a hand on the mare's neck and untied the looped halter rope. She stood for him while he scrambled and wriggled and kicked his way to her back. And then they were off, the mare in an easy lope, the gelding trotting after, the colt stopping his wild show-off career and hobbling hastily and ignominiously after his departing mother.
They pulled up before the ford, the boy sliding off to throw the halter rope to his father.
"Shall I get the harness?" he said, and before anyone could answer, he was off running to come back lugging one heavy harness, tugs trailing little furrows in the damp, bare earth. He dropped it, turned to run again, his breath laboring in his lungs. "I'll get the other one," he said.
With a short, almost incredulous laugh, his father looked at his mother and shook his head before he threw the harness on the mare. When the second one came, he laid it over the gelding, pushed against the heavy shoulder to get the horse into place. The gelding resisted, pranced a little, got a curse and a crack with the rope across his nose, jerked back and trembled and lifted his feet nervously and set one shod hoof on his owner's instep. The father, unstrung by the hurry and the heat and the labor and the exasperation of a morning when nothing went right, kicked the horse savagely in the belly.
"Get in there, you damn big blundering ox! Back, back, you bastard! Whoa, whoa now!"
With a heavy rope for a towline, he hitched the now skittish team to the axle. Without a word, he stooped and lifted the boy to the mare's back.
"All right," he said, and his face relaxed in a quick grin. "This is where we start her. Ride him around in circle, not too fast."
Then he climbed into the ford, turned on the switch to magneto, fussed with the levers.
"Let her go," he said.
The boy kicked the mare ahead, twisting as he rode to watch the ford heave forward as a tired, heavy man heaves to his feet. Begin rolling after him, lurching on the uneven ground, jerking and kicking and making growling noises when his father let the emergency brake off and put it in gear. The horses settled as the added pull came on them, flattened into their collars, swung in a wide circle, bumped each other, skittered. The mare reared, and the boy shut his eyes tight and clung. When he came down, her leg was entangled in the tow line, and his father was climbing, cursing, out of the ford to straighten it out.
His father was mad again and yelled at him.
"Keep them apart! There ain't any tongue! You gotta keep Dick kicked over on his own side!"
And again the start, the flattening into the collars, the snapping tight of the tugs under his legs. This time it went smoothly. The ford galloped after the team in lumbering, plunging jerks. The mare's eyes rolled white and she broke into a trot, pulling the gelding after her. Desperately, the boy clung to the knotted and shortened reins, his ears alert for the grumble of the ford starting behind him. The pup ran beside the team, yapping in a high falsetto, idiot monotone, crazy with excitement.
They made three complete circles of the backyard between house and chicken coop before the boy looked back again. "Won't she start?" he shouted.
He saw his father, rigid behind the wheel, heard his ripping burst of swear words, saw him bend and glare down into the mysterious innards of the engine through the pulled-up floorboards. Guiding the car with one hand, he fumbled down below, one glaring eye just visible over the cowl.
"Shall I stop?" The boy shouted. Excitement and near despair made his voice a tearful scream.
But his father's wild arm waved him on. Go on, go on, gallop him. Pull the guts out of this thing. Run him, run him.
And the galloping, the furious, mud-flinging, rolling-eyed galloping around the circle, already rutted like a road, the ford, now in savagely held low gear, growling and surging and plowing behind, the mad yapping of the dog, the erratic, scared bursts of runaway from the colt, the mother in sight briefly for a quarter of each circle, her hands to her mouth and her eyes hurt, and behind him in the ford, his father in a strangling rage, yelling him on, his lips back over his teeth and his face purple, until finally they stopped. The horses blown, the boy white and tearful and still, the father dangerous with unexpended wrath.
The boy slipped off, his lip bitten between his teeth. Not crying now, but ready to at any moment. The corners of his eyes prickling with it, his teeth tight on his misery.
His father climbed over the side of the car and stood looking as if he wanted to tear the thing apart with his bare hands.
Shoulders sagging, tears trembling to fall, his jaw aching with the need to cry, the boy started toward his mother. As he came near his father, he looked up. Their eyes met. And he saw his father's blank with impotent rage. Dull hopelessness swallowed him. Not any of it, his mind said. Not even any of it. No parade, no ball game, no band, no fireworks, no lemonade or ice cream or paper horns or firecrackers. No close sight of the mountains that throughout every summer called like a legend from his horizons. No trip, no adventure, none of it, nothing. Everything he was feeling was in that one still look. In spite of him, his lip trembled and he choked off a sob. His eyes on his father's face, on the brows pulling down and the eyes narrowing.
Well, don't blubber, his father shouted at him. Don't stand there looking at me as if it was me that was keeping you from your picnic.
I can't help it, the boy said. And with a kind of terror, he felt the grief swelling up, overwhelming him, driving the voice out of him in a wail.
Through the blur of his crying, he saw the convulsive tightening of his father's face. And then, all the fury of a maddening morning concentrated itself in a swift backhand blow that knocked the boy staggering.
He bawled aloud from pain, from surprise, from outrage, from pure desolation, and ran to bury his face in his mother's skirts. From that muffled sanctuary, he heard her angry voice.
No, she said. It won't do any good to try to make up to him now. Go on away somewhere till he gets over it. She rocked him against her, but the voice she had for his father was bitter with anger. As if he wasn't hurt enough already, she said.
He heard the heavy, quick footsteps going away, and for a long time he lay crying into the voile flowers. And when he had cried himself out, and had listened apathetically to his mother's soothing promises that they would go in, the first chance they got, go to the mountains, have a picnic under some waterfall, maybe be able to find a ball game going on in town some Saturday. When he had listened and become quiet, wanting to believe it, but not believing it at all, he went inside to take off his good clothes and his shoes and put on his old coveralls again.
It was almost noon when he came out to stand in the front yard looking southward toward the impossible land where the mountains of the moon lifted above the plains and where, in the town at the foot of the peaks, crowds would now be eating picnic lunches, drinking pop, getting ready to go out to the ball field and watch heroes in real uniforms play ball. The band would be braying now from a bunting-wrapped stand. Kids would be tossing firecrackers, playing in a cool grove.
In the still heat, his face went sorrowful and defeated, and his eyes searched the horizon for the telltale watermark. But there was nothing but waves of heat crawling and lifting like invisible flames. The horizon was a blurred and writhing flatness where earth and sky met in an indistinct band of haze. This morning, two strides would have taken him there. Now, it was gone.
Looking down, he saw at his feet the clean footprint that he had made in the early morning. Aimlessly, he put his right foot down and pressed. The mud was drying, but in a low place, he found a spot that would still take an imprint. Very carefully, as if he were performing some ritual for his life, he went around, stepping and leaning, stepping and leaning, until he had a circle 6 feet in diameter of exact, delicate footprints, straight edge and curving instep, and the 5 round dots of toes.
Jack Davidson and Lilo Way joined yours truly, Isaiah Sheffer, in this rendition of Wallace Stegner's story, Goin' to Town. If you've always wanted to be a selector of shorts yourself, here's your chance. On June 9th, 2010, Selected Shorts at Symphony Space in New York will feature published stories selected by you, our audience nationwide. Go to selectedshorts.org/favorite to submit your story suggestions. Then in the spring, you'll vote for your favorite of the final contenders. And second, if you've always wanted to try your own hand at writing a short story of your own, enter the annual Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Contest to be judged this year by Nathan Englander. Complete information about the contest can be found at selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.